This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Tonight on CNS News, a San Francisco woman struggles to keep her home from foreclosure. And are you wondering what effect the recent oil spill will have on your local fish market? We have the answers. Later on, we'll take you to an event few people get to see, one that involves guys, guns, and cake. Good evening. Welcome to CNS News. I'm Gabriel Lee.
And I'm Brittany Johnson. In tonight's first story, San Francisco residents caught in the mortgage crunch could get help soon. Robin Yurovich talked with one woman whose mortgage payments have doubled.
Mom.
Giselle Quesada raised four kids in her house in San Francisco's Ocean View neighborhood. Now she cares for her 86-year-old mom. 5 years ago, the house was paid for, so she went to the bank to help her son buy his first house.
When I refinanced, they told me that it was fixed. That's what all I heard. I didn't hear them telling me 2 years or 3 years of a short time of it being fixed, and then the interest rates would go up.
Quesada is a repair woman for AT&T. Her adjustable rate mortgage cost $600 a month at first. Now it's $2,000, half of what she earns. In part, she blames the bank.
The person that did the loan, who knowingly knows what potentially what's going to be happening, did not explain that. They share a big part of that.
The subprime mortgage crunch has hit the East Bay hard. But in San Francisco, the Board of Supervisors is debating ways to ease the crisis. Supervisor Gerardo Sandoval supports asking banks for a moratorium on foreclosures.
Give the homeowners, you know, a couple of months to come up with a plan.
Supervisor Sandoval is also proposing that the city set aside funds to bail out homeowners, provided the banks agree they'll work out deals to avoid foreclosure. But not everyone thinks this will solve the problem.
Out of 100 defaults, if they save two or three, you know, there's some gain, but it's a minimal gain. But they're not going to be able to stop 100% of defaults.
Giselle Quesada says she'll work as many hours as she can or borrow from her kids if necessary to save the house she's lived in for 28 years.
I mean, it's tough for me, but I've got my house, I've got a good job, you know, and I know that I'll weather the storm.
The city hall measures are expected to pass. That's good news for hundreds of San Francisco homeowners in trouble. For CNS News, I'm Robin Yurovich.
An oil spill closed the San Francisco Bay in November. Now the governor is lifting his ban on crabbing and fishing there. But that won't help salmon fishermen, who say this season has been the worst in decades. Kieran Goldman reports.
Bay Area fishermen catch adult Chinook salmon in the fall as the fish head toward the rivers to spawn. But this year, the catch for fishermen like Paul Blackburn was much lower than expected.
In the last 4 or 5 years, by, you know, first 2 months of the salmon season, the fish are gone.
Mike Hudson is a commercial salmon fisherman. He says the scarcity of salmon has tripled prices in the market.
A few years ago, our wholesale price for salmon was $2 a pound. This last year, the wholesale price for salmon was around $6 a pound, so all the prices go up to a point where the customers can't really afford to buy salmon anymore.
Biologists say several factors contribute to salmon's decline.
There's habitat degradation, there's harvest pressure, so fishing, there's hydroelectric dams that have gone in to reduce the spawning habitat, and there are hatchery influences.
According to Barnett Johnson, salmon raised in hatcheries and released into streams now make up the majority of salmon caught in the Bay Area.
My results show that only 10% of the fish that we catch offshore are actually of wild origin, which indicates that 90% of the fish were reared in a hatchery.
The big question is whether we should be doing more to restore salmon habitat and boost the number of wild salmon in rivers and oceans.
So when we see declines in any particular stock, it just raises kind of some red flags about how the environment is doing and how we as stewards of these resources are doing.
And it's not just about the environment. Salmon are important to California's economy and to the consumer.
I'd like to get salmon out there to everybody because it's a good food.
Fishermen like Mike Hudson hope the catch will improve next year. In the meantime, the federal government is compensating fishermen and others in the salmon industry for money lost this season. For CNS News, this is Kieran Goldman.
A local homeless community on the Albany waterfront could be kicked out soon if the city follows through with its plans to evict them. Lauren Rudzer takes us there.
The Albany Bulb is a one-time landfill that's become a popular park in the East Bay. For dogs, it's a playground. For bike riders, an adventure. For Catherine Cody, it's home.
I'm comfortable. I'm happy. I'm content. I have a good time out here. I'm well-loved and well-cared for, and I'm safe, and I got plenty of time to read.
Catherine Cody, who goes by Casey, and her dog Chompy moved to the Bulb a year ago after Casey lost her job and a subsequent eviction left them homeless.
It's inconvenient not having hot water, a toilet. It gets a little cold and damp sometimes, but I got plenty of blankets, I got Chompy, and I'm warm.
When she became homeless last year, Casey sought refuge for herself on the Bulb, fearing for her safety in shelters and to escape the trappings of life on the streets.
There are thievery, disease, drugs, all those things I'm trying to get away from. Criminals! Those people living in the streets, I'm terrified of them. I really am. Whee! All the comforts of home.
Casey may have to reconsider shelter life.
The city of Albany, citing health and safety concerns for park visitors, and with a no camping law in effect, could eventually evict Casey and the other five residents of the Bulb.
An eviction is not the only dark cloud looming over Casey. A former drug user who's been clean for 7 years, she was diagnosed with hepatitis C a year and a half ago.
Tomorrow, next week, or 5 years or 10 years down the road, it's still a fatal disease, and it's slowly eating away at my life.
Casey recently got her medical treatment back on track. With the help of the Homeless Action Center, Casey visited the doctor for a full physical. She also received full emergency and prescription coverage from the city of Berkeley.
If I get into trouble or get sick, I've got care now. Which has been something that's really scared me.
Casey hopes to find a place of her own where she can take care of herself. But until then, or until the city forces her to leave, there's nowhere else she'd rather be.
It's beautiful. And I'm safe.
For CNS News, this is Lauren Rutzer reporting.
Now here's the first of our voices from around the bay.
I mean, certainly the fishing industry has been heavily damaged by the spill. It's been about 3 weeks getting ready, and then the oil spill came upon us, so it couldn't have come at a worse time. These crabs are scavengers. They live on the bottom. They eat things that live in the mud. They would eat, say, oil seabird if it sank to the bottom. I think we'll see, you know, some marketing problems. I just want to go fishing and make some money.
Officials later gave fishermen like John Meller the green light to harvest crab in bay waters. Our next three stories highlight green projects around the bay. First, Jenny Chu takes us to Oakland, where a campaign hopes to provide jobs while helping the environment.
Over 400 people gathered at an Oakland church to share a meal and hear about green jobs.
Some people are surprised for us to be saying we're talking about a green city and brown folks.
Ben Jones of the Ella Baker Center says working in the green movement is a way out of poverty for Oakland's youth and young adults.
You can fight poverty and pollution at the same time if you have a green movement. If you have a movement that says we're not going to let our young people go without work when there is so much work that needs to be done.
The city has pledged $250,000 to train the next generation in solar power and energy efficient jobs.
I think it's the right idea at the right time.
Ian Kim, the Green Collar Jobs Director, says community leaders see a natural connection.
In a town like Oakland that is both leading on the environment and has a lot of problems with poverty and pollution and education, that we can put those two things together to create new solutions that meet both needs.
Oakland's Green Jobs program starts next spring, but solar training has already begun in nearby Richmond.
We need to make a change in our environment, and there's a tremendous amount of work that needs to be done, and we need the bodies to do the work. For me, the biggest success is employment. And out of our last training, one of our gentlemen, Andre Collins, just got a job with Sunlight and Power. And that's it. That's the bottom line.
It was the starting line for Collins, a husband and father of three, who was out of work for several years.
I had been searching for a job, but due to past mistakes and having a criminal record, no one was willing to just open up and give me the chance. I like it that it's a win-win. It's hard work, but they pay you for your hard labor. So it's good money. It's good for the environment.
Jones believes the movement will spread nationwide.
We are building a movement that's not just going to change Oakland. We're building a movement that's going to change this country, and I'm so proud to be a part of it. Thank you very much.
And the federal government is a part of it. Congress recently authorized $125 million for national green jobs training. This is Jenny Chu reporting for CNS News.
Next, we'll look at two programs in Berkeley and San Francisco that teach about farming and healthy eating while also providing jobs. First, Jacob Seamus reports from the Alamany Housing Project in San Francisco.
Tucked between Interstate 280 and the foot of Bernal Hill in San Francisco lies Alamany Farm. A former dump site, these 4 acres were first converted into farmland by the city's League of Urban Gardeners, or SLUG, in 1994. But after the organization dissolved, this once fertile plot again sat abandoned and untended.
A lot of organizations came through here, and our kids did not get hired. So by watching them suffering, I had to step in and build a program myself after SLUG fell.
The farm reopened in 2005, this time as a partnership between residents of Bernal Heights and the Alamany community, a 165-unit public housing complex where residents have seen too many of their young people turn away from school and toward the streets.
Drugs. It's hard for a lot of the young ones to resist it because of the money that's in it.
But through a combination of environmental education, healthy foods, and employment for their children, residents are now seeing the benefits of the farm on their neighborhood.
This farm here brought a lot of kids back in school. They grazed them, went up.
They know they got to show that report card.
Just because they have a job. The kids is happy, the crime done slowed down, and everybody is getting along.
Much of the success is due to the efforts of dedicated volunteers who tend the vegetables, flowers, and fruit trees.
It's great for them to have this opportunity to be outside, to be learning about produce and you know, eating healthy.
This is our farm over here, and I eat strawberries here.
Some say Alamany Farm represents a model which could and should be imitated by others seeking new ways to revitalize their communities.
There's nothing but progress out here right now. Our dreams is right here in our own community.
Reporting from San Francisco, this is Jacob Simas for CNS News. And now, across the bay, Jordan Ehrlich reports on another urban garden where young kids in Berkeley are learning organic farming for the first time.
We don't want to be pulling this stuff into the pathways. We want to leave the soil on the bed. Okay.
Becca Prager leads the Teen Employment Program at the Berkeley Youth Alternatives, or BYA, an after-school program where at-risk kids earn money by cultivating an organic garden and landscaping city parks. And while they rake, shovel, and harvest, these kids learn real-world job skills and much more.
Perfect. Thank you. The job is a hook. That's our way to get teenagers down here and involved, because the paycheck really adds a sense of worth. But then also, we're learning in a really deep way about health and nutrition and about our choices.
Like before, I never used to like think like, oh, I don't want no carrots or I don't want no peas. But since I know what it takes to grow and to put in to, you know what I'm saying, making the carrots and making peas and stuff, I like, you know, I respect like, okay, I'm going to eat this.
Along with teaching kids to eat right, BYA also provides kids with counseling, mandatory study halls, and fitness programs. And for kids who have been in trouble with the law, BYA offers a probation program that stresses prevention instead of incarceration.
This is BYA World, and in produce we trust.
Roy Johnson is working hard to become a rapper. But before he came to BYA, his life was off track.
Typical afternoon, probably smoking weed and drinking and, you know, robbing folks.
Roy spent over 10 months in a juvenile facility, but now with the help of BYA, he has his life back on track. And if his dream of becoming a rapper falls through, he says he wants to be a group counselor at a juvenile hall.
Because I feel that it's kids out there that's like just like me, and it's going to be kids that's going to need that guidance, that extra push, and I just want to be there to give them the extra push that they need.
When you see them blossom into who they want to be, regardless of who that person is, that's what makes it totally worth it.
And BYA makes it worth it for the teens, too, where they gain the confidence and self-esteem they'll need for their future. Jordan Ehrlich, CNS News.
And now, here's another voice from around the bay.
I'm Mother Mary Ann Wright, and we feed the homeless every day. In 1980, the Lord wakened me in the middle of the night and told me what he wanted me to do. hospice, feed the hungry. You name it, we get it right here to give to those. And we put it on those racks out there, and then we allow them to get what they want. This is a mission. This is God's mission, not mine.
Some residents of West Oakland fear their health is endangered by diesel truck emissions from the Port of Oakland. Now the port is considering a crackdown to clear the air. Molly Snyder-Fink tells us more.
These trucks and their diesel-burning engines have been part of the fabric of West Oakland for as long as residents can remember.
Either see it, smell it, hear it, feel it.
But now regulations proposed by the California Air Resources Board will force truckers to clean up their big rigs.
We didn't wake up and purposely say, let's go get old trucks that spew out a lot of diesel. I mean, the diesel truck is all that can pull these trailers and containers down the road.
Mike Evans operates 35 trucks at the port. He's all for the environment, but...
I know we're on a big green kick for everything, and I understand. I love green. But you have to be realistic, too. It doesn't do any good to put a whole lot of people out of business.
The proposed regulations will gradually reduce emissions by requiring truckers to upgrade and replace older, more polluting vehicles.
We are more exposed to the diesel trucks 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year.
Margaret Gordon is a longtime West Oakland environmental activist. Gordon has asthma and lives on the corner of a major trucking route. A few years ago, the scene you see here of a truck idling outside her window almost killed her.
The diesel smoke was coming through my bedroom window, and the next thing I know, I was choking and gagging. That's when I really understood the public health issues of having trucks in West Oakland.
At a California Air Resources Board meeting recently, a member of the Natural Resources Defense Council spoke up.
It's just shocking to me that when vehicle owners find out that their polluting equipment might be sickening the public, that they're not jumping to do something about it.
The driver's closer than anybody in the community.
He breathes it every day.
I just don't want you to think that it's someone else's problem. It's my problem, too.
The regulations will come before the Air Resources Board in early December. Until then, truckers and community members alike are holding their breath. This is Molly Snyder-Fink for CNS News.
Developers are luring middle-class homebuyers to one of Oakland's poorest neighborhoods, and the first residents are already moving in. Emma Cott has the story.
Congratulations. Hi. Nice to see you.
Barbara and David Miller experienced two firsts recently. They bought their first home, and they were the first ones to move in.
Well, Mr. and Mrs. Miller, on behalf of Pulte Homes, we really want to congratulate you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
She's a nurse and he's a respiratory therapist, and they've been renting a tiny one-bedroom in San Francisco for the last 20 years. So they were relieved to find this condo for $400,000 in just minutes from the Bay Bridge.
If the development continues like it's supposed to, I expect this to grow, to be developed.
Central Station will add 1,500 units of housing to an abandoned industrial site where West Oakland meets Highway 880. But in a neighborhood where the median income is under $20,000 a year, affordable housing advocates say that the vast majority of local residents will be shut out.
There are 23,000 people in West Oakland, and most of them are working people of color. And everybody cannot afford a $500,000 condo. That's gentrification. We don't want that.
It's a very vibrant neighborhood.
Developer Rick Holliday has responded to community protests. Now, plans for Central Station include subsidized rentals, as well as special loans to help local people buy. Even if they can't live there, many West Oaklanders feel that the influx of wealth will be a shot of adrenaline for their community.
It'll help the business around here, too. Yep, stores, everything. It'll help everything. But I think it's going to do good for down here.
And in a city that's low on money, the project will generate much-needed property taxes, a portion of which could go towards affordable housing.
Almost.
Meanwhile, the Millers are looking forward to watching their community grow. They're just happy to have a place that they can call home.
What do you think?
For CNS News, this is Emma Cott reporting.
In September, a 22-year-old father and youth leader was shot and killed in a West Oakland park. Now, the community is urging an end to the violence and honoring his mother's loss. Annabelle Peavy reports.
Thank you to Jesus for giving me such a beautiful, beautiful son.
Ida Hancox came to Poplar Recreation Center today to celebrate the life of her son, Willie Tapman III. He was a Boys and Girls Club leader who was shot dead 2 months ago after an argument over a basketball game.
He not only was my son, he was my best friend. I want to say to the community, let's get out and reach out to people more, and let's bring this community back together, because right now this community has a broken heart because of what happened over a basketball game.
Oakland's Parks for Peace program is one citywide attempt at taking a stand against such violence.
Unfortunately, Willie Tatum was the 99th young person that was killed on the streets of the city of Oakland.
Audrey Jones Taylor is the head of Parks and Recreation in Oakland, a city that had 148 homicides last year alone.
We need the community to be engaged and to be the eyes and the ears in the community and take the community back. We like to say there's more of us than there is of them. You know, that means we need you to come out and take some responsibility.
Speakers from the community are urging residents to make some sacrifices in the name of nonviolence.
If you want peace in this community, what are you willing to do as an adult, as an elder, as a community leader? What are you willing to do? What are you willing to sacrifice?
Using all the available resources, we can make this park and all of the parks in our city safe for our children once again.
Mo Campbell coaches at the rec center where Willie Tatman played basketball the day he died.
I want people to feel free about coming to the center. We have to make sure that the community understands that this is a safe place. We don't want people thinking that it's not a safe place. It is very safe.
The next Parks for Peace event is January 12th at Oakland's Bushrod Recreation Center. For CNS News, this is Annabelle Peavy.
And now the last of our voices from around the Bay.
I decided to join the military for education. My parents couldn't really afford to send me to college, so I decided to do that. Kind of went kind of blind to what the reality was. When teachers ask, like, is anybody a veteran? Like, sometimes I'll raise my hand, sometimes I won't. I'm kind of shy and I don't want anybody asking me questions. And for me, it was just a stepping stone to get to where I am now.
Lodi Public Schools may ban a 7th grade textbook because one family worries their son is learning too much about Islam. Lyra Frederick has the story.
I'm here today to ask the school board remove the textbook History Alive, the Medieval World and Beyond from our schools.
Karina Self objects to the textbook's use of prayers from the Quran and its description of jihad. She claims that 4 chapters devoted to the history of Islam are too many.
Our children are being spoon-fed this information with sugar on top.
Karina's husband, Jim Self, is a recent Iraq War veteran. Even though the couple is now homeschooling their 12-year-old son, they still want the textbook removed from the district. But school board member Bonnie Castle doesn't think history educators should stop teaching about controversial religions.
Knowledge is power. My way of seeing this is the students need to know about the Islamic religion because otherwise they will never understand the people who believe in that religion.
And such controversies are nothing new in Lodi. Around 1,000 Pakistani Muslims live in town. 2 years ago, the FBI investigated possible terrorist connections here. Local Muslims feel news of those events created an unfair view of their religion.
They made the name, you know, Islam and terrorist synonymous. You know, where if you said Islam, you had this, the first word that came to mind was terrorist.
Mark Kalanico, Lodi's curriculum administrator, says each religion receives equal class time, and this helps students sort through a complex post-9/11 world.
Do we want to do a curriculum that's a mile wide and an inch thick, or do we want to really get into depth? The effort of social studies here is to try to build enough background knowledge in 6th, 7th, and 8th grade so that when kids get into world history, they have a better understanding of the background of it.
Religion in public education has always been controversial, and in Lodi, teachers struggle to incorporate the study of religions without appearing to favor one over another. For CNS News, I'm Lyra Frederick.
The Muslim religion is gaining popularity across university campuses today. Reporter Manal Ahmad brings us the story of one Berkeley woman who recently converted from Judaism to Islam.
My name is Laura Miller. I'm 23 years old, and I'm Muslim.
For Laura Miller, converting to Islam in February 2007 was not an overnight decision.
My interest began during my undergrad years at Cal. I took a variety of classes, like Middle Eastern-related classes. I took Arabic, a course on religion.
The educational pursuit soon turned into something deeper. But it wasn't until a trip to Egypt with a group of Muslim friends last winter that Laura felt she was ready.
I was talking with this convert girl who I know, and she was like, I mean, if that's what you already believe in your heart, that there's no God but God and Muhammad is the messenger of God, well, then you're already a Muslim.
Being Muslim has brought many changes in Laura's lifestyle.
I stopped drinking, stopped going clubbing, and my sleeves started to get longer. Now covering up more feels right to me.
But Laura still has to face the biggest challenge of all, confronting her Jewish family.
They'd probably think I'm betraying my culture, my family, my tradition. My dad once said, I would feel differently if you converted to a different religion, like to Buddhism or to Catholicism, than if you converted to Islam.
Since September 11th, the rate of conversion to Islam in the U.S. has more than tripled, with over 20,000 people converting each year.
The sense of community and sisterhood, much, much stronger than what I ever experienced in Judaism. I really feel a sense of belonging.
Now, Laura is waiting for the right moment.
I don't want them to not know forever. I just needed to feel confident in my decision so I can demonstrate to my parents, hey, I've been Muslim since February. Have you noticed like a really bad change in me? Have I like gone off and become a crazy terrorist? No. I'm a normal citizen of American society. You know, I'm working two jobs. I'm staying out of trouble. What more could you ask for?
For CNS News, this is Manal Ahmed.
For our last story tonight, Joe Bush takes us to Alameda for a rare look at the Marines' annual birthday celebration.
It was no ordinary celebration, as Marines came dressed in their finest to celebrate the 232nd birthday of the United States Marine Corps.
Well, every year on November 10th, the Marine Corps celebrates its birthday.
Major Henry Weed's family has served the Corps for over 75 years.
The tradition is to have the oldest and the youngest Marine highlighted. We read the message from the 13th Marine Commandant, General John A. Lejeune.
Marines have acquitted themselves with the greatest of distinction, winning new honors on each occasion until the term Marine has come to signify all that is highest in military efficiency and soldierly virtue.
Last year was a year of change for these Marines as they transitioned from an artillery unit to force reconnaissance to meet the growing demands for ground troops in Iraq. And this year will prove as equally trying as they activate on December 3rd and begin training for a deployment to Iraq in April.
Things that I ask of you is to give me your Marines for this period of time where we do this tough training so that they can go to Iraq, be successful in their mission, and then come back, as I said, in your loving arms.
Even with the deployment to Iraq looming in their near future, the Marines here in Alameda with 4th Force Reconnaissance still find time to honor and respect their Marine Corps.
Not necessarily just the birthday, but just being able to be around my friends, the guys I've served with, it definitely means a lot.
It's the one night of the year where we kind of enjoy ourselves, we relax, we put on our best uniform that the Marine Corps has.
It just means to be carrying on the tradition of like the founding fathers, the Marines that died before, and try to carry on their legacy. And
since 1775, the Marines have marched boldly to the sounds of the guns. Oh. Fought fiercely and honorably to defeat the scourge of tyranny and terror. We are Marines. That is what we do.
Reporting from Alameda, Joe Bush, CNS News.
That's it for our show. I'm Gabriel Lee.
And I'm Brittany Johnson. Thanks for watching CNS News. See you next time.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.